Good evening. My name is Perry Hoffman, and I am president of the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder. I want to welcome you all to this second call for the NEA BPD Fall Call-In Series. There are over 200 people registered to be on this call, and we're delighted to have such an excellent response to this effort. Hopefully, you have received the handouts that go along with tonight's lecture. Please check your email box. If you haven't received them, please email us at neabpd@aol.com, subject slides, please. Before I introduce our speaker for the evening, I'd like to orient you to our organization for those who did not attend our first call-in with Dr. Alan Frazetti on September 18th. We are a 10-year not-for-profit organization run by all volunteers. This call-in series is one way we are marking our first decade of work and saluting the many hours of free time given by the professionals to help the BPD community. No one is compensated for their time that they give to the organization, including the wonderful professionals who are donating their time to participate on these call-ins. I want to thank all of you on this call personally for your donations after our call-in with Dr. Frazetti. We are so appreciative to people who support us in our effort to support you. If everyone on this call donated something to NEABPD tonight, it would be wonderful to help us in our work. Please think to do that and go to our donate button on our website at the top right corner of the home page. No amount is too small, and every dollar of support goes back to supporting conferences, a website that is number two on Google, and our hallmark program, Family Connections, as well as other initiatives that would take a call unto itself to mention. Also, I want you all to know that we have a conference in Atlanta on Friday, November 4th. Please go to our website for more information. We also have a training for new Family Connections leaders that same weekend on November 5th and 6th, and we hope we can encourage people to attend. Now for the call. Some housekeeping. Everyone is on mute, so there is no background noise during the call. Dr. Ken Silk will talk for about 30 minutes, and then we'll throw open the floor for questions. We ask that if you have a question, please send an email to neabpd.com, subject question. It's now my pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Kenneth Silk, who is professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Michigan Health System. Dr. Silk is the secretary and treasurer of the International Society for the Study of Personality Disorders and is co-editor of the Personality and Mental Health Journal. In addition, he is the scientific editor of NEABPD's Forum for Professionals at www.bpdforum.com. Last and certainly not least, Dr. Silk is the chairman of Scientific Program Committee at the 2012 annual meeting of the American Psychiatric Association. This is the meeting where psychiatrists come together and share the latest information on psychiatric disorders. As was done in 2009, NEABPD is proud to say that we will be doing a workshop for psychiatric residents, along with Dr. Silk, Dr. John Gunderson from McLean Hospital, Dr. Brian Palmer from the Mayo Clinic, Dr. John Olden, the current president of the American Psychiatric Association, and Jim Hall, a Family Connections leader and board member. This will all be at the 2012 meeting in May in Philadelphia, all in the effort to educate psychiatrists in training about borderline personality disorder. We will present the latest information to help reduce the stigma in the psychiatric community on the disorder and hope to be able to alter some thinking, perhaps most important being that BPD is treatable and people do recover. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Silk.
Good evening. So I'm going to try and make this interesting. I'll be talking to myself because I'm not getting any feedback. But what I'm going to do, I guess you have the slides on a PDF, so I'll suggest when it might be best to move on to the next page. I've put out the slides as a kind of a thin outline because I hope to touch on a number of different things, and I know that there are different disciplines from psychiatrists and psychologists to social workers and maybe nurse practitioners and consumers and other people may be out there. So I'm going to not necessarily make this a heavy psychiatric presentation, but if you are a psychiatrist and you have a chance to ask some questions and want more specifics, please let me know. So the first slide that we're looking at is BPD, psychopharm immediate issues. And one of the things that I think most of you know is that there really are no medications that carry a specific indication for the use in the treatment of personality disorders. As I go on in about six slides from now, I'm going to come to perhaps what some suggestions might be with respect to using medications in different borderline patients, but there are no medications or no specific medication that that has a specific indication, and therefore when one's using a medication for a patient who has borderline personality disorder, and the use of these medications is certainly not uncommon, that we're using the medications at least off-label. One should make note at this point in time that the APA put forth, American Psychiatric Association put forth guidelines in 2001 on the treatment of borderline personality disorder. And those guidelines relegated medications to an adjunctive role, emphasizing the fact that psychotherapy or psychotherapeutic interventions are the ones that have the most data, and those should be the ones that would be used, and again, the medications being used adjunctively. In 2010, I guess it was, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, the NICE guidelines, were released out of Great Britain, and those guidelines were even less enthusiastic about medications. They insisted that there was really no data and that medications, if they're going to be used with patients with borderline personality disorder, ought to be used very briefly, ought to be used in crisis, or ought to be used to treat another psychiatric disorder that may be coexisting along with the borderline personality disorder. So, for example, when a borderline patient is really in a major depressive episode, and if people care to ask questions about the borderline personality disorder and depression, I'm happy to talk about that, because very often borderline patients' loneliness and emptiness and chronic unhappiness is, in my opinion, misinterpreted as a major depressive episode, and then patients are given medications to try and break or treat or mitigate the depression. But the depression, I believe, that most borderline patients suffer is not the depression that we would think of as major depressive episode, though again, borderline patients are certainly prone to suffer concurrent major depressive episodes. But you don't want to run into an over-enthusiastic psychopharmacologist who's trying to get the lonely, empty, unhappy person with borderline personality disorder to change that posture through psychopharmacologic interventions. Overall, even if you use a medication for a comorbid disorder, so for a major depressive disorder or for a panic disorder in a patient that has also borderline personality disorder, most of the research that's been done says that the medication is less effective even for that comorbid disorder than it would be if the same medication were used for that disorder when there was no coexisting borderline personality disorder present. So what you have is, and I always like to think about medications in terms of cost benefit. So what is the cost to the patient and what is the benefit that the patient might benefit from, might receive from the use of medications? So I've just mentioned that to some degree these medications are less effective in patients with borderline personality disorder on the one hand, and also on the other hand, these are folks that seem to be exquisitely sensitive to the side effects of the medications. So that what happens is the cost goes up as the sensitivity to side effects is increased, and the benefit goes down when the clinical response to medications let's say for an Axis 1 disorder that also has pre-existing borderline personality disorder, goes down. So you can appreciate that the cost-benefit ratio is different. I say this not to suggest at all that medications shouldn't be used in this group of individuals, but just that the thinking, particularly among psychiatrists, the thinking needs to be different because one needs to have, I think, different expectations and try to decide whether to use a medication based upon different parameters. I'm on to the next slide that's entitled Transference and Countertransference Reactions. And that one of the points I wish to make in this slide is even if you're, let's say, a psychiatrist just treating a borderline patient or a patient with borderline personality disorder with medications and you don't want to get into what you would think of as a complicated relationship with the patient, that we do know that patients with borderline personality disorder have lots of feelings about lots of people that they meet, even people that they might meet casually, so that these are people who may instantaneously or very early on after meeting someone decide that the person's wonderful or that the person's terrible, so that the psychopharmacologist can't simply assume that simply because he or she is writing prescriptions for medications and not getting into psychotherapy that somehow that protects one against the transference or countertransference reactions.
Ken, let me just interrupt you. I want to make sure that people are aware that to send the questions, it's neabpd@aol.com. Just so in case people have questions, they can start sending them in, neabpd@aol.com. Thanks.
Okay. Yep. And I'm on a portable phone with another portable phone backing up. So, Perry, if for some reason you start to not be able to hear me, just send me an email and I'll grab my other phone that's being charged up. So that these are folks who have intense feelings and connections with many of the people whom they encounter or meet. So one always needs to be aware of the relationship that you have with these people. And just emphasizing what I said before, that like attachments, there can be strong feelings that come early in the relationships. And once those attachments are formed, that they're hard to change. Now, that's not always a negative aspect of treatment because if the patient has a positive attachment to the psychopharmacologist or to the psychotherapist, that the positivity of that attachment may often be useful to help both the therapist or the treater weather some of the storms and keep the patient kind of connected. But also that it's important to be, as I said, cautious about how you prescribe and what you prescribe. And one, I think, feels there's often a transference paradigm, I think, that patients feel about physicians or caregivers or helpers. Because I think that these are people who have been invalidated, if we go to Lenihan's idea of invalidation, throughout their lives. And so when they request a medication, and if the psychiatrist feels like that's not a good medication or that the medication ought to be different, or if they're asking for minor tranquilizers like benzodiazepines, and the physician doesn't feel that would be in the best interest of the patient, that the patient can often feel like that individual is just like everyone else, who's denied and withheld from them, who doesn't understand how they feel and frustrates them. So though one would wish that one could put a cocoon around oneself when one's prescribing medications, nonetheless, I believe that no pharmacologic treatment is ever purely psychopharmacologic. So moving on to the next slide, the question that I think that anyone who prescribes medications and or anyone who's treating the patient psychotherapeutically and is thinking about whether they should or shouldn't prescribe medications needs to ask themselves a series of questions. Is it time to try a medication? And if you want a medication to be tried, why try it now? At this point in time, I think it's important to reassure the patient if you're moving from not requesting medications to requesting medications or not having prescribed them to wanting to prescribe them. It doesn't mean that one thinks that the patient is more ill. I often tell the person that I want to prescribe medications because I have a better sense of how they function, where their vulnerabilities are, and some of the particular symptoms that may be giving them the most trouble. And if the symptom is reminiscent of a symptom in an Axis 1 disorder or a symptom complex likely to be found in an Axis 1 disorder, then I feel like that there might be some wisdom in beginning to try a pharmacologic trial with a medication for someone who would have that pure Axis 1 disorder. And when one does that, one needs to decide how you want to track improvement, because these are folks who are always in crisis or often in crisis and come with another series of complaints. And what you don't want to do is get distracted too early by trying to then prescribe a second or a third medication because there's been a new series of complaints or a new crisis. So I talk about with my patients, so starting with one medication, trying to figure out what the symptom is that we wish to track, what we would see as improvement, and not adding a second medication until we can figure out whether the first medication is being used for or is being helpful for the symptom or symptom complex that we set out to target initially. And I may repeat this over and over again, but one can't medicate away emptiness, loneliness, or the anticipation or fear of abandonment. So moving on to the next slide, I got ahead of myself and said that the psychiatrist can't really be distracted by crises, or should try not to be, because you do want to be able to follow the progress of the target symptom. And I often talk about with patients that it took a long time for them to develop the problems that they had. And it will take a good deal of time to get things better, even if it's to improve through psychotherapy or using pharmacologic agents in order to assist that improvement. Very often, more and more these days, the psychotherapy is being provided by a non-psychiatric physician, and the psychiatric physician is writing the medications. And in treating patients who can be as complex as these folks can be and have a tendency to divide the world into good and bad, that the only way that there can really be an effective, in my opinion, psychopharmacologic treatment is that there's collaboration, appreciation, and understanding between the people who are involved in the treatment. So you don't want to be a psychotherapist having your patient being treated by an overenthusiastic psychopharmacologist because that person may be responding to an upsurge in symptoms around a crisis, and you as the psychotherapist have a good sense of why that crisis may be occurring. And many of the crises that these folks get into are really crises triggered by interpersonal situations. So I mentioned above the issue of symptoms or symptom complexes, but also most of the studies that have been done with in psychopharmacology, while they initially looked at symptoms and symptom complexes, now more often look at what I would consider to be dimensions of psychopathology. And so one might, and I'm going to be talking over the next couple of slides, about thinking about how one might treat specific dimensions of psychopathology that occur in patients with borderline personality disorder. So moving on to the next slide, traits to consider in personality disorders. So one can think of these dimensions as traits. And people have talked over and over again about different dimensions or traits in borderline personality disorder, though one might also think about the kind of interpersonal sensitivity as another trait in borderline personality disorder, though there's not been any studies done that I'm aware of with respect to the psychopharmacology of that particular trait. So if you look at the slide in front of you, the four traits that are there, and this is from a wonderful paper written by Larry Seaver and Ken Davis way back in 1991. It's the lead paper in the last issue of, in the December issue of 1991, and it's really worth reading. One could get an appreciation of how smart these folks are, and if anybody's been following all the work that Larry Seaver has done over the last 25 or 30 years, he is one of the best thinkers in personality disorders around. So what's listed in this slide, and I'm not going to get into detail, are all the different symptoms that borderline patients might report experiencing and how one might be able to classify them under those four dimensions of affective instability, cognitive perceptual disturbances, impulsivity and aggression, and the anxiety inhibition dimension. Suicidality is in color different from the rest because it could be classified under affective instability or it could be classified under impulsive aggression, and in a similar vein, anger could be not only listed under impulsive aggression, but under affective instability as well. So looking at the next slide, I reviewed all of the meta-analyses that have been done on borderline patients and tried to determine what those meta-analyses concluded with respect to if a person had or was suffering from a disorder where one of those dimensions, you as the therapist or the psychopharmacologist, felt like that one of those dimensions was really the dimension that stood out most prominently, then how might you consider treating them with the different classes of psychoactive medications. So AD stands for antidepressants, MS mood stabilizers, AP antipsychotics. And as you go down the list, when the class of medications, MS for mood stabilizers, is there without parentheses, it means that that's where the most evidence is. When there's parentheses, it means that there's some, but somewhat weak evidence for the effectiveness of that class of medications. And when there are, when two medications there, such as if you go down and see the third line, Nozay, and antidepressants and mood stabilizers, that means that the data appears to be equivalent for the effectiveness of those medications in that meta-analysis. But what's interesting, frustrating, and confusing about what's behind that table is that essentially those studies are looking at some set of the same 24 studies. So they're looking at the same, some subset of the 24 studies. And what they're finding is they're coming up with different results, even though they're looking at the same studies and trying to subject those studies to a meta-analysis. So if you look at the vertical columns, except for the cognitive perceptual disturbances, the third vertical column, where antipsychotic medication repeatedly shows itself to be the most effective, The affective instability and the aggressive impulsive dimensions, they have all different kinds of results. But what's interesting is that mood stabilizers at least seem to be effective. Again, summarizing all of these meta-analyses seems to be effective in both of those dimensions. Perhaps antidepressants can be effective with the affective instability dimension, but the asterisk after the antidepressant in the summary says that if concurrently depressed. And by if concurrently depressed, I just want to reiterate there that if the person is in a concurrent major depressive episode and not someone who's complaining of chronic depression, chronic unhappiness, and chronic loneliness. There's little data for the anxiety inhibition dimension, and not many of the studies looked at overall global functioning. So I'm sure that people, well, I'm hoping that people will have questions about that. But those are really the seven meta-analyses. And as I said, that they all are looking at some set, some subset of the same 25 studies. And the last group, the last five groups, NOSA, the World Federation Society of Biological Psychiatry, the Duggan, the Toronto study, and the Ingenhoven study, are really looking at about 20 studies each, and about 16 of those studies are common to across all of those meta-analyses. So sometimes it's emphasized that somehow meta-analysis is the key to trying to understand all these things, but certainly it isn't. So according to my watch, it's a little bit after 8:30, so I'm going to try and then go through the issue of how I think one might prescribe medications. And when I see my patients, I talk to them about the limitations of the medications, and I try to be modest with respect to what I expect would be the therapeutic benefit. And this needs to be done prior to prescribing them. I talk to them that I'm going to treat them with one medication at a time. I want the medication to be there long enough that it can get a response, and sometimes that may be up to 2 or 3 months. And I'm against making major psychopharmacologic decisions during crises, that I'm careful and I'm very stingy with using benzodiazepines, but I would use it for a short time, maybe less than a week. And as I said before, I'm kind of pedantic and slow, trial and error. But it took them a long time to get there. And if we're steady, this is more of a tortoise process rather than a hare process. The next slide just briefly touches on the idea of chemical imbalance, that there are more and more patients come to us from probably watching too much direct-to-consumer advertising, that somehow that there should be a magic drug for them. And I try and talk about the fact that almost everything that we feel and think is chemically mediated. So the idea of changing chemicals, or that chemicals are involved in the bad things and not involved in the good things, is not a good way to think about it. And that we do believe that borderline personality disorder has chemical underpinnings, but we just haven't figured out a way to write those chemicals. The next slide talks about getting on and off medications. As I said before, these are folks who are highly sensitive to side effects, and one may need to talk the patient through the side effects. I urge my patients to call me or contact me before they get so annoyed that they just chuck the medication in the waste paper basket. But I also tell them that my goal is not to have them feel worse on medications, but to feel better, so that they should call me, and together we can decide whether we should continue and or switch. And most of these medications can cause weight gain, and the borderline personality population is a series often of young women who have self-esteem problems and are also sensitive to how they appear. So one of the major negatives to these medications or one of the costs is weight gain. So I think that we need to pay more attention in general in psychiatry to the fact that almost all the medications that we use, perhaps save for topiramate or Topamax, really can cause significant weight gain. And while some can cause, have a reputation for causing weight gain, I can tell you that there's not been a psychiatric medication that I haven't used that some patient has found it to really lead them to have a lot of gain in weight. But at the same time, these are folks that can get attached to medication, and even if you, the therapist, feel like the medications aren't working, the patient may have a great attachment to the medication, so that making a decision to take the patient off a medication or to change medications may not be as simple as we would like it to be. I'm going to skip the next slide. Well, I'll just briefly say it's easy to get to polypharmacy, which can increase side effects and weight gain.
Ken, please, you have time, so please do go through this because I think a lot of people are concerned about this.
Okay. So it's you can get on it's easy to arrive at polypharmacy, and I should say when I admit my patients to the inpatient unit and I talk about trying to keep patients on as few medications as possible, the first thing the residents point out to me is that my patients are on many more medications than what I suggest. So, but I always say, well, you should do what I say, not do what I do. But one could appreciate a well-meaning psychopharmacologist getting to the point of arriving at polypharmacy. The patients have impulsivity and aggression, and you treat that with an SSRI. Add a mood stabilizer for affective instability. You feel like they're still effectively unstable and unhappy, and wonder if you can augment the depression with thyroid or something like that, or lithium, perhaps that you can help them feel less empty. And when they're stressed, they get paranoid, so it would be nice to throw in a little atypical antipsychotic, and they're not sleeping. So you can appreciate how one might get there, and again, I emphasize that I like to use one medication at a time, and I would much rather switch than augment unless I really felt like I was stuck. And very often we have augmentation strategies primarily for depression, and again, I would suggest to make sure that the person's in a major depressive episode and you're not trying to treat pharmacologically the emptiness and loneliness. But also, a sensitive, caring physician can wind up giving the patient medications, particularly when the patient's in crisis and they're feeling absolutely terribly and they feel like they're trying to hold on to the concrete side of a building with their fingertips. So they come to us in terrible distress. They want more meds. They want new meds, different meds. They want you to fix it. And I often talk to them about the fact that I remind them with respect to how I had talked about the medications at the beginning, that I wanted to do one at a time. Let's see whether the crisis goes away in a couple of days, and it often does go away in a couple of days. And then I remind them that it's probably better to be on less medications rather than on more medications. But in the meantime, I'm also talking to them about the fact that if I give them medications, I expect them to take it. And if they're not going to take it, I'm not going to be annoyed with them, but I sure want to know that they're not taking it. So to use medications one at a time, not to add a second until you think that there may be a response to the first, and then you've identified a different trait or dimension that you would like to treat with the second medication. Again, be cautious about augmenting. Don't make medication changes during crises. And you want to try and choose the safest medication in the group of like antidepressants. You would shy away from using the tricyclics because they can be pretty lethal. So we're back to the question of, do medications work here? And there are people who can get pretty hot, and I've been in some pretty good arguments by people who think that just by giving the lecture, I'm encouraging medication when the data is weak. But what we do know is that some patients certainly do get better or certainly feel better, feel less anxious or less depressed and or less impulsive. But we don't know the specifics. We don't have indications for the medications, for which medication to be used in which situation. So when they do work, they seem to work in ways that are mysterious to us, and so I describe that as nonspecific. That also using medications, there probably is a high placebo response in the clinical trials with borderline patients, patients with borderline personality disorder. And one could give a medication, and the patient may have a placebo response as well. And it's very difficult to know whether there's a placebo response, but if the patient's feeling better after 3 days and then horrible after 3 months, then it would seem to me that it's more of a placebo response. Or if they're feeling horrible after 4 weeks, that seems to me to be more of a placebo response. But sometimes these are patients whose lives are so chaotic that it's difficult to judge whether things are better or worse for them with respect to their taking the medications. So sometimes we need to take the patient off the medication and ask them to ask the people whom they deal with every day, their family, their roommates, whether or not they noticed a difference in the patient as they went off the medication. Often the changes, the improvement once you put someone on medication can be slow and subtle, and therefore it's difficult to really know whether there's been significant improvement. And I say all of this with the caveat that there's been no long-term studies. The longest study done was for 16 weeks and then a year follow-up, and there's no continuation study. So the 16-week study, which was done in, I believe, 1993, was called the continuation study because they were giving the patient medication for more than 8 weeks. So that should get us to the last slide. And I hope that what I said made some sense. And I'd love to answer your questions and or expand upon anything in those slides or any questions that might be somewhat related to those slides.
Well, Ken, thank you so much. For those of you who don't know Ken Silk, he is probably the top pharmacologist in the country working with people with this disorder, and people often turn to him, professionals turn to him to find out problems that they're encountering in medication. So, Ken, we're so appreciative of your time. Let me get to some questions. There was a few that intertwined, so how do you distinguish between bipolar and BPD, as bipolar seems to many times be diagnosed with borderline due to the mood, the swing in moods? How can one tell if it's truly a manic episode or a symptom of borderline?
Well, that's a good and interesting question. I think that patients that are truly bipolar are somewhat easier to separate from borderline personality disorder than patients who might have what's called bipolar 2 disorder. So a patient who's truly bipolar is talking fast, moving fast, spending a lot of money, impulsive, taking interpersonal risks, but this is not their normal MO, modus operandi. But this can happen and will usually occur in spurts of a week or two, and will be accompanied by a need for little sleep, not the inability to sleep, but a need for little sleep. And most bipolar patients say, I didn't sleep because sleep was a waste of time because I had so much to do on my plate. And the mood instability or the mood lability in borderline patients can be an hour-to-hour or day-to-day fluctuation. I had a patient who felt like that she needed to wear clothes that was compatible with her mood. And so she could get up in the morning and feel really good and wear bright clothes. And by noontime, she'd have to go home and change into grays and bright.
I'm assuming that we lost Ken, but I'm assuming other people are there. Hopefully he'll sign back on. He said that his phone might run out of juice, so hopefully we'll get him back in a minute or two. For those of you who did not get the slides, please email me at neabpd@aol.com, and I will send them to you right away. I also need to let Ken know that we lost him. So hold on. Thank you for your patience, and hopefully we'll have him back in a minute. Again, if people want to send in questions, please don't hesitate.
Hi.
Yeah, Ken, we lost you.
I know.
Okay,
my
okay.
Phone. So I'm sorry. So, so that if I can get back on track, I apologize to everyone. That she would have to change her clothes because her mood would change, and then her mood could change back before the end of the day. And these are folks that when they can't sleep, it isn't that they don't sleep because they have too many things to do. These are folks who would like to sleep but are too anxious or agitated or irritated or annoyed in order to be able to get restful sleep. So those would be the key things that I would think would go on. And that when patients are manic, they're expansive or grandiose. They feel like they can do and cure anything. And borderline patients rarely get into that kind of mental state.
Thanks, Ken. Yes, and how do you distinguish, what causes BPD to develop in young adults? Can PTSD be a cause?
That's another good question. So research shows that somewhere between, depends upon the data that you've looked at, 40 and 75% of patients with a borderline personality disorder have also had some significant abuse in their past. And that abuse, well, we thought early on that was a sexual abuse, but that can also be emotional abuse or emotional neglect or psychological abuse. But what we also know is that patients develop borderline personality disorder without having had abuse in their lifetime. So how might one distinguish the two clinically? In my opinion, if a person has PTSD, a person can function reasonably consistently in most situations, except in those situations that are reminiscent of or that trigger, let's say, the trauma. Borderline patients behave in ways in which most of the world can trigger the reactions that PTSD patients would react to with respect to the specific trauma. So the world, or many, many more things in the world, seem to be triggers for borderline patients, and PTSD patients can usually function quite well outside of situations that cause the trauma. And they can, if they can successfully avoid those situations, then they have a much better chance and level of functioning than borderline patients would. Now, this is a big, long discussion, and I'm sure that someone could challenge what I said, but at least that's where I would start off with thinking about how one might be able to distinguish them. Perry?
Okay, terrific. Can you tell us about alternative medications such as omega-3 What can be taken safely and what also works?
Well, there's been two studies on omega-3. One was a European study, and one was a study by Mary Zanarini and Francis Frankenberg. And both of those studies revealed that in some patients, omega-3 seems to be an effective medication. Omega-3 is an interesting compound because it's been at least accused of being successful across a number of different psychiatric disorders. And what we don't know is, or what we don't have is the more rigorous clinical trials of omega-3. But I could say that taking omega-3 certainly can't hurt. And certainly many people feel like if one could take omega-3 and do exercise or some form of systematic relaxation, and if that's done consistently over a period of time, that those alternative therapies can turn out to be as effective as any of the psychopharmacologic treatments, but no one has really made that comparison. There was another part to that question, Perry?
Sorry, what can be taken safely and what also works? So, no.
Well, as I stated above, I'm not sure that there's any medications that work. I think that they can have some modest effects on some of the symptoms of that patients with borderline personality disorder suffer. They might be able to diminish some of the impulsivity to allow patients to think before they act, or give them at least some small window of time to think before they act. If a person gets very paranoid when stressed, some of the atypical antipsychotics can help that kind of paranoid distortion that occurs. When one talks about safety, most of the SSRIs are pretty safe medications, and most of the atypical antipsychotics are reasonably safe medications, in that even if they're taken in excess, in most instances, there's not too much danger in taking them in excess. The older antidepressants, the tricyclic antidepressants, are pretty dangerous because they can have direct effects on cardiac conduction on the EKG, and the therapeutic levels and the toxic levels are pretty close to each other. So someone who's quite impulsive or has strong suicidal impulses, I would shy away from using that medication with them. The atypical antipsych. The other group is mood stabilizers. And the mood stabilizers, which some people think may be, as a group, the most effective medications in patients with borderline personality disorder, they certainly have a toxicity that's much greater than the SSRIs and significantly greater than the atypical antipsychotics. Lithium also, as a mood stabilizer, can be quite toxic in overdose.
Okay. Are the effects of psychotherapy over time similar to taking certain psychotropic medications?
In borderline patients, both the NICE guidelines and the APA guidelines would say that psychotherapy over time is much more effective than medications.
Okay. Is the placebo effect greater with people with BPD, and if so, should this be explained to patients?
No one's really studied the percentages of the placebo effect, but I guess that part of what comes up in the meta-analyses, or why there's some inconsistencies in a study, in one study, let's say, that would use an atypical antipsychotic, and then another study that would use the same atypical antipsychotic, and the results would be contradictory in the two studies. Often the study that shows no effectiveness has to do with the fact that the placebo response rate, or the people who were not given the active medication but given a placebo pill, also had a high response rate. But I say this with respect to the fact that most studies of pharmacologic studies of borderline patients had less than 50 patients. And so if you have a significant group of patients that have a placebo effect and you have a small number of people that you're studying, the placebo effect may wash out the therapeutic effect that you get for the active medication. So that would be what would be called a type 2 error, that there is a significant finding, but you can't see it, again, because the numbers are too small, versus what's often referred to as a type 1 error, which is you find a significant finding, but it's really not significant, again, because the number of subjects is too small.
So here's one on adolescents. This is from a therapist. Many of my clients are on ADHD medications plus antidepressants. Nothing seems to work, and they're really appearing borderline. They may be on the extreme end of adolescence, though. Do you have any thoughts on medication and behavior that mirrors BPD in teens?
That mirrors BPD in teens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess because the issue is, people believe that it can't be diagnosed until age 8.
Oh, I see. Well, I think that most people would now say that BPD can be diagnosed in adolescence. Certainly Alec Miller has written a book on DBT in adolescence. Andrew Chanin, who's from Australia, has done, C-H-A-N-E-N, has done wonderful work showing that that BPD seems to show up in similar ways in adolescence. I guess that one of the questions, and that may be useful to talk about with respect to psychopharmacology, is that I think that DBT can't hurt an adolescent, particularly an adolescent that's having behavioral problems, even if that adolescent is doesn't meet full criteria for borderline personality disorder. The skills that one can achieve through DBT, or even the skills that one could achieve, let's say, through mentalization-based therapy, are skills that are very important and can be quite useful as one moves into adulthood. I think that often people worry about diagnosing BPD in adolescence because, number one, you're going to stick the adolescent with a label. And then number two is you're going to treat the adolescent with psychopharmacologic agents. And what I would say is that I would hesitate to treat an adolescent, particularly a younger adolescent, with medications, even if I thought that the adolescent had BPD. And I just want to go back to the fact that most of the meta-analyses that looked at the use of antidepressants, that antidepressants were in general not effective for the depression or the mood instability in borderline personality disorder, except when the patient was really having a bona fide major depressive disorder. Not that they were feeling depressed or empty. I said that 3 or 4 times. So I guess I would go back and take a look at whether the person is complaining of chronic unhappiness, and that's why they're being treated with an antidepressant, versus when they're actually in a major depressive episode. Perry?
Is there any information linking the thyroid and thyroid medications to BPD?
Not that I'm aware of. Certainly, patients who have low thyroid can appear to be lethargic and amotivated and depressed, because that's what having low thyroid can do. And people that have an overactive thyroid can appear anxious and impulsive. And there's a term called hyperthermic. They're like hummingbirds moving from place to place, so they have a high level of agitation. But in either one of those extremes, those patients would appear more, the hyperthyroid, more anxious and perhaps depressed because they're being worn out by their anxiety, or unmotivated and depressed. But neither one of those pictures would bring up in my mind that the patient had borderline personality disorder.
Okay. Can you tell me where my doctor or I can look up reported unsafe interactions and how these interactions can be expressed?
Say it again.
Can you tell me where my doctor or I can look up reported unsafe interactions and how these interactions can look?
Well,
yeah.
So I know there's something that we physicians use that that's name is escaping me a second, but I can pull that up. That can help us determine interactions. The thing called Micromedics, but one has to register for it. And there's a program called Hippocrates, Hippocrates, which also can give drug-drug interactions. But I found that you can, you know, I found that nowadays the fastest way, if I wanted to know, let's say, if Prozac and Topamax had interactions, I would just go into Google and I would say drug-drug interactions, Topamax, Prozac, and it would come up. There would be a number of things that would come up. And sometimes WebMD will show it. But I think if you just straight out Google the question, you know, more than 80% of the time, you'll get the answer.
Okay. If the patient gives permission for the therapist and the family to have contact, is it desirable to encourage family or others to report changes, both positive and negative, when medications are being changed?
Tricky question. I guess it all depends upon the objectivity of the family. And you don't, you know, so if you have a family that's kind of, and I should put it this way, I'm not suggesting that families that deal with borderline patients aren't people who are going to be anxious and stressed and worried and hyper alert or hyper vigilant. But at the same time, you don't want the family to report every little change. So I guess that if you wanted to use the family as a kind of a reporting agency, and if the patient agrees with that, then I might suggest, if I put a person on medications, I might suggest that 8, 10, or 12 weeks later, having a face-to-face meeting with the patient present and with the family present so that it can be discussed. But that would be the way that I would proceed, because I think that in these systems that involve patients and families that have been repeatedly stressed for years and years and years, people have a tendency to, on the one hand, to be overreactive or to be too negative, too pessimistic, or too hopeful. And so in those situations or opinions or perspectives can change not only among patients but among families, and so it would be very hard to kind of interpret the data. So, but I think it's a great idea to, if the patient's agreeable, to sit down with the family every 2 or 3 months with respect, or 2 or 3 months after instituting a medication change.
Okay, how about this one? If someone is chronically depressed, is electroshock therapy a potential option? And where does that fit in with borderline?
If a person, again, I would want to know what is meant by chronic depression and do they meet the criteria of a major depressive episode. Like psychopharmacologic treatment that seems to be less effective in patients with borderline personality disorder that's also present with major depression, that people with borderline personality disorder and major depression may respond to ECT, but they don't respond as vigorously, and the response from the ECT does not seem to last as long as it would for a person who had depression and not the coexisting borderline personality disorder.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how about this one, Ken, because I know this is such a big issue. You did touch on it a bit, but in terms of weight gain, what medications don't cause weight gain?
Well, the only medications that doesn't cause weight gain and can cause weight loss is topiramate or Topamax. Mm-hmm. Among the atypical antipsychotics, Geodon or ziprasidone is marketed as weight neutral, and probably among all of the atypical antipsychotics, that medication, ziprasidone, is probably the one that has the least weight gain. Then the next least weight gain would be aripiprazole or Abilify. The most weight gain is seen in clozapine or Clozaril, followed by olanzapine, or better known as Zyprexa, and then followed by quetiapine or Seroquel. So I guess I would list it for most weight gain, clozapine, olanzapine, quetiapine, aripiprazole, and then ziprasidone. Or if I can use the trade names, I would say Clozaril is a trade name. Clozaril, Zyprexa, Seroquel, Abilify, and Geodon in that order. Among the mood stabilizers, there's also can be significant weight gain with all, any and all of them, save for topiramate. And some people can find taking a Depakote to be extremely weight gaining, but other people won't gain weight. But I've seen people gain significant weight on Depakote, valproic acid, or tegretol, carbamazepine. So there's no really good psychiatric drugs other than, as I said, topiramate and perhaps Geodon, where weight gain isn't or can't, where weight gain for certain people can't be a significant problem.
Okay, thank you. This will be our last question. Can a manic episode be induced by drugs such as antidepressants and still not be bipolar, or can going off all medications subtly induce a manic episode that is still not bipolar?
You know, the question about whether giving people who have a bipolar tendency antidepressants, or people who are bipolar, and inducing a manic episode, leaving out whether they're borderline or not, is one that there are two camps. Some people say yes and some people say no, and it's a complicated question. I think that people can get agitated and anxious and appear both hyperactive and dysphoric, that is, not look manic, but look manic in movement, but they appear to be more uncomfortable in mood. And that can be a side effect of the antidepressant, particularly the SSRIs, though we rarely see it. But I often think that it's that kind of side effect that was tied in with those cases where people on SSRIs became suicidal. The second question is a very curious one, and I don't really know how to answer that. There are certainly when people suddenly stop medications, they can also have a reaction of increased anxiety, or some people talk about feeling brain zaps or feeling muscle twitches. And so that situation can lead to people being more anxious and being more hyperactive. But I would think, and I don't mean this in an arrogant way, a good clinician who's thoughtful and thorough, at least in the latter instance, should really be able to determine that that's a withdrawal from the medication, or what we now euphemistically call a discontinuation syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Ken, thank you so much. I do want to also let our callers know that you can go on our website, borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com, and there's several lectures that Ken has done at our conferences. So if you want to hear more about what he's saying, they're there for free watching, and I'm sure some of it we've discussed tonight, but there are other things that he's also brought up at different conferences. So again, Ken, thank you so much. Thank you for everything that you always do for us.
Well,
and I've already gotten emails from people saying, what a great lecture, thank you. How can we get in touch with him? So you've made an impact on a wider audience tonight.
So, and people can email me. I need to tell you I'm going out of the country and I have two presentations to prepare before. But if you want to send me emails after October 15th, after October 17th, I'm happy to read them. If you send them to me in the next week or 10 days, they're going to get lost in the backup. But I'm happy to try and answer a question that's a short question, because I type even more slowly, and but I can kind of go round and round an issue. So I'm happy to try and answer a short question, so you can feel free to contact me.
All right, thank you. And also to let everyone know that Ken will also be presenting at our conference in Atlanta on Friday, November 4th. So if you're able to come, go on our website and you can register. So thank you again, and thank you to everybody. And if there's any way that you can help support our cause, we'd be so appreciative just by going on our website and clicking the donate button. Thank you very much, and we look forward to having everybody back on the call next week with Dr. Barbara Stanley talking about a suicide strategy plan. Thank you to everybody. Bye-bye.